From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're revisiting some of the best conversations so far this year, and the first is quite timely. Over the last several weeks, the House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol has presented evidence and testimony they believe reveals an orchestrated scheme by President Donald Trump to overturn the 2020 election. Earlier this year, we learned intelligence officials did in fact receive tips and threats in the days leading up to January 6, alerting law enforcement agencies. So, what went wrong? To better understand the complexities, I spoke with Mike Cena, who heads the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, among a network of 80 fusion centers that met 2 days before the insurrection about the threats they were all receiving. I spoke with him on the eve of the one-year anniversary of the insurrection about those fateful days and the hard lessons learned. Mike, if you first can share with us your backstory, what brought you into this field and when did your career begin?
Well, I started out in law enforcement in 1993, and you know, my focus is originally was vice and narcotics. Worked a lot of that. Started out with the California Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, and back in 1997, moved over and was transferred to a major narcotics task force that was primarily focused on, at that time, Colombian and Mexican narcotics organizations, drug trafficking organizations, and you know, not too long after that, when 9/11 rolled around, immediately on that day, I got a call that I was being transferred to a new organization that was being formed to kind of deal with major threats, just like what occurred on September 11th. And they didn't have a name for it at that time, but they said that the focus is going to be on information sharing, trying to address the threats as quickly as possible and improve information sharing, along with criminal intelligence analysis. So that eventually became what is known as the National Network of Fusion Centers. And right now there are 80 of those centers. In California, there are 6 of them. And each center has an area of responsibility and role in information sharing to identify threats using a number of tools. And that whole organization that we have is owned and operated at the state and local level with the support of the federal government. But it really is a conglomeration of bringing together a lot of federal, state, local, tribal, territorial partners that have created this network of information sharing that we have in the country.
With your specific lens in law enforcement and partnering with Homeland Security, what comes to top of memory? How do you reflect on what happened?
Well, and many people read the Washington Post story about kind of the conversations that I was having on January 2nd with Donnell Harvin, who at that time was the director of the Fusion Center in Washington, D.C. At the NTIC. And, you know, those conversations when he called me and was describing kind of all of the online sentiment, but more than just sentiment, the people online that were talking about, you know, bringing weapons to the United States Capitol, which are prohibited. People that were threatening, you know, oftentimes implied violence. And to the point where there was enough conversations about that online that Donnell was worried. And, you know, he's one of those people that has, you know, in Washington, D.C., they have events all the time. But it caused the, as he said, the hair on the back of his neck to stand up. And as we were talking, it was very early in the morning on a Saturday. I said, well, you know, what would you like to do? And he goes, well, I think we need to talk with all of our other fusion centers. And I said, absolutely. Whatever you want, we will do. And we actually set up a call, you know, on January 4th, that Monday, to talk with as many of our partners as we could. And I really expected a small number of people to show up. And then we had almost 300 people show up. And I'd asked Donnell to invite kind of his partners in Washington, D.C., to make sure that we're all on the same page about the threats that we're seeing. And ultimately, the gist of that call led me to sending out an email to a number of partners around the country about what we're going to do to try to share information more effectively. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, you know, on January 6th itself, obviously, you know, there was a lot of angst, a lot of disappointment, and a lot of concern about, you know, the protection of the DC area, and especially the facilities that were impacted are you know, and to the threats to our members of Congress, which, you know, just like everything else we're trying to protect, protecting our legislators, protecting our institutions, protecting our processes is critical. And there was a lot of, attempts to make sure that information was shared in a timely manner from our side. But once we pass information on, it's really up to the law enforcement agencies that have protection responsibility on how to, you know, use that information, that data.
We're talking about 80 fusion centers across the U.S. and U.S. territories. You said 300 people joined that call on January 4th, 2 days before. When you handed that over to Homeland Security or the FBI, what was their response?
Well, in a lot of the areas, and this is a topic that's come up, and there's been testimony about this, that from the perspective of, you know, the federal agencies, I mean, there are nuances to what they can do as well, especially with, you know, online threats that are implied. Oftentimes, threats that we see online, we don't know the exact location of that threat. People don't usually post their address. And, if people post their address when they post to social media, there'd be a lot less postings of social media. But we don't have oftentimes the exact address or location of folks. So when we talk about the things that the FBI or DHS may receive as far as information, they may have the information, but if it doesn't meet those federal thresholds for follow-up, they really don't have the authority. And that's one of the problems that, you know, many people don't understand, is that each of the federal agencies has very specific authorities of what they can and can't do for investigations, collection of criminal intelligence, or follow-up on leads. So if it doesn't meet those thresholds, our goal is that we get that information to state and local agencies that may be able to work within the parameters of their authorities, which are oftentimes broader in the law enforcement spectrum. But ultimately, we need an address. We need some way to identify.
But were there threats that were specifically involving or mentioning the U.S. Capitol, the joint session of Congress, January 6th, and specific lawmakers?
Yeah, oftentimes, and for those that were more specific threats to individuals, if, you know, any threat that goes to an individual goes back to that agency. So if it's a threat to a member of Congress, it's the U.S. Capitol Police that have that, along with the FBI for wherever their field office location would be, or wherever they are in the country, wherever they live, along with the local agencies. So, you know, it's a multi-tiered approach to who has individual threats to members of Congress. But oftentimes, a lot of the threats that we saw were more in general, not specific to, I'm going to go out and storm the castle. It was more, I'm going to DC, I'm going to bring weapons, and we're going to start whatever we're going to start. But not specific to a act of violence that a person was going to do, but reading into it and looking through the data, there was a lot of implications that there was something bad that was going to happen.
Given that on January 4th, just 2 days prior, you organized that conference call with regional intelligence centers, and yet 300 people join. Is that unusual?
Well, it was actually one of the first times that we've had a call like that. I mean, we actually felt like, hey, I think we're ahead of the game here. We actually have a lot of different threats that when you bring them together, there may be, you know, something that is going to happen that we're worried about. So part of this was bringing together all these folks, but not knowing that something's going to happen. But I felt that we were a lot more ahead of the game than we have been on other threats that have been executed. So it wasn't something we normally do for these events, of bringing a call before the event. There's a lot of post calls after something bad happens, but this was one of the first times that we'd had a call beforehand where there was such an interest in the call, because a number of people were seeing the same things around the country, but there were also a number of people who were on the call who didn't know that certain posts were being put out there online that involved their state or their jurisdiction. So we're able to connect those people literally on that call as we're happening, having the call, bringing those people together, so they knew that there were threats coming from someone in their state. At least it looked like they were coming from someone in their state, and that way they could dive a little deeper at the state and local level on whatever information they could dig up.
Given that on January 4th, you thought that you were all getting ahead of this, how did you absorb what unfolded on January 6th? What was going through your mind?
it was a little heartbreaking, to be honest. You know, especially, you know, we never know from the intelligence side of law enforcement and how we operate. Our goal is to provide information to that will hopefully get to decision makers to, you know, take whatever action they need to deal with the threats appropriately. And so, you know, at that point, you know, and I always tell people that, you know, no person that works in information sharing and intelligence realm is going to ever tell anybody that something's going to happen 100% of the time. There's a likelihood, and that's what we often say, is a likelihood that some type of bad things will happen. And this is why we believe this. And this is our counter hypothesis of why even our hypothesis may not be right. Trying to explain that to making sure that it gets to the right people. And oftentimes, you know, in retrospect, you know, some of the things that I think we've lost over the years are things like the course on criminal intelligence for the chief executive. We have had such turnover in law enforcement that I just don't feel that law enforcement in general across America from the executive level has a real understanding of how intelligence works and how to use the information that they do get, which oftentimes, and you'll hear this and have heard this probably during some of the testimony that's been provided so far, that, you know, people didn't see that as the front page item on their briefing books. And I think that, you know, that's something that obviously many of us have been trying to change over this last year to make sure that people understand how to use information and intelligence. And there actually is a national criminal intelligence sharing plan. There's a plan that's existed actually since 2003 and was updated in 2013 that unfortunately many law enforcement executives and many people in law enforcement have not read that plan.
Do you look at January 6th as a failure in response?
I do.
Or prevention?
Look at it, I think that, you know, from my perspective, I think the information sharing and intelligence was doing what it was supposed to do. It was the execution that did not go through as hard to point fingers after the fact. A lot of people are pointing fingers right now.
Yeah. What I'm hearing from you, and obviously intelligence centers and law enforcement agencies are layered and they're multifaceted. It seemed like information was going out, but obviously you have local, regional, federal, and state agencies that ultimately threats and tips and information either hit dead ends or fell through the cracks.
Well, and part of that, and I just to let you know, because everyone thinks that when you call law enforcement, that everyone in the country knows that that tip or lead came through. And there are so many silos of tips and leads. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies out there. So many silos that, you know, of I would say silos of excellence that people have their data in their own area, but it may not be shared. And the goal of the network of fusion centers is that if a tip or lead raises to the level that you think there may be some validity to it, that you share that with the fusion center. And that way it can be shared nationwide. And since what happened on January 6th, we've developed dashboards, which allow us to see threats in real time across the entire country during fast moving events. You know, it's too difficult to, you know, keep in contact with everyone when you may have hundreds of threats that are moving at the same time. So being able to have a dashboard capability where you can see where threats are, summary of those threats, and the source of those threats allows us to better be able to connect information that was disconnected previously. Now, just because you have a whole bunch of dots on the board doesn't mean all the dots are connected. But if you don't have all the dots on the board, you can't make those connections.
Mm-hmm. What should have been done differently from when you got that call in the early morning of January 2nd to having the conference call of January 4th? What would you have wanted to be done differently?
I wish, and we didn't have it at the time, but I wish we had that dashboard capability up and running. I wish that we had, and I've mentioned this to Congress also, I wish that our technology that we currently have was modernized. We were using very old technology to communicate in a way that nobody actually really communicates anymore. So I wish we had that. The other component of that is I wish that we had that follow-up with the executives to make sure that that they got the briefing from the people that had all the information. And I think that, you know, if we could have, you know, changed the way things happened prior to January 6th, it would have been to make sure that that analyst that had that full picture was able to directly brief each of the executives. You've got to have a good intelligence section, but you also have to be able to share information quickly. And that's the one thing that the, you know, the 9/11 Commission, you know, this idea of horizontally sharing information with all the people that have a need and right to know the information is critical. And that's something that we still stumble with across America.
In your opinion, why were local and federal law enforcement agencies in the D.C. area seemingly unprepared for the attack at the Capitol when your intelligence center, many more across the country, raised concerns days before the attacks? And as you're watching it unfold from California.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give you an opinion and to criticize anyone for the actions that they took. You know, I will say that everyone has a piece of the problem and a piece of the solution. So I couldn't really say, you know, if this agency or that agency had done this or that differently. But I do think that if you start off with a foundation that everyone agrees that information sharing is one of the most critical things that we do to make sure that we prevent threats, that all the rest of the dominoes will fall in place. That if we make sure that, you know, individuals aren't briefed, that everyone that has a need and right to know is briefed, especially at the executive level. And this goes from the top executive to the patrol officers. Everyone has to understand what the potential threats are and how to be prepared for them. But if we have silos where people are not given the information, then we have gaps that create pockets where bad guys or individuals or groups can exploit and cause extreme harm to the public. And directly, as we saw on that day, to individuals, including the poor U.S. Capitol police officers that were barraged by, you know, by the melee weapons and the crowd that beat them, along with all the members of Congress that they were, you know, putting themselves in front of to protect them from, you know, being kidnapped, basically, from a mob of people.
Given what was in place and what existed, I know that we're talking about learning lessons from January 6th, but could January 6th have been mitigated or prevented?
You know, my belief, and that's because I'm in the world of prevention, is that every horrible event that we encounter could be prevented. Oftentimes, if we've got enough information, if we've got enough data, and we've got enough analysis, if we can identify the individuals that are the threat, if we can identify the target of the threat, and we can keep the threat actor away from the entity that we're trying to protect, that will reduce the threat. We can't stop every threat. That's never going to happen. But I have seen it work. I've seen this work effectively, where we have seen individuals who have been unable to execute attacks because of information sharing, because we got the right people at the right time in the right place. And that's really what our role is to make sure that we get the people the data and resources that they need to intervene on threats as best we can. So could there have been things that had been done to prevent that attack? Absolutely. But, you know, every time an attack happens, we see a buildup of infrastructure to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Given that we're focusing and you're talking about the lessons learned from January 6th, where do you say the threat of domestic terrorism stands now? Has it increased or has it decreased since then?
I don't believe it's decreased. I think that's still one of our top threats in our country. I mean, we have seen, and, you know, after 9/11, there was a huge, you know, focus on international terrorism. But we've always had domestic terrorism as a threat to our country. We've always had individuals, whether it's far left or far right, violent extremists that have gravitated towards harming, you know, whether it's members of the government, law enforcement, the public, but people who have, been acquiring weapons or explosives and have, you know, done major terrorist attacks around the country. And so we've got, you know, just a combination of probably the worst of times where we have a large group of disgruntled people, far left, far right extremists. And, you know, we always say, hey, we respect and we absolutely do respect First Amendment rights and people's right to privacy, civil rights and civil liberties. But when people start talking about doing violent acts, that's where we come in. So I think that, you know, the threats are have changed over the years from a focus on international terrorism. We shouldn't look away from that. We are, you know, constantly dealing with the threat from international terrorists, but we have a large group of people in the country that are willing to use violence to get their point across, whatever that point may be. And in the middle of that are a bunch of our law enforcement partners and fusion centers trying to prevent that and keep those folks from doing those threats and criminal activity. But we have people that are armed, and people that are armed that shouldn't have weapons for a number of reasons, but they're building their own weapons and people are selling them, like as I said, across the country. And I see that as a huge threat to the nation.
That was my conversation with Mike Cena, executive director with the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. The Fusion Center is among a network of 80 that received threats about January 6th in the days leading up to the insurrection and alerted law enforcement agencies. Our interview first aired in January. Up next, we revisit our conversation about a unique program for veterans and first responders centered on moral injury and how it differs from PTSD. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. As we continue to reflect on some of the best conversations on Insight so far this year, we turn to a unique center of healing for veterans and first responders in Sacramento that struck a chord with us and still brings one of our producers to tears by the end of it. The Center for Post-Traumatic Growth in Rancho Cordova offers treatment for moral injury, a new field in psychology which differs from PTSD. In April, I spoke with Dr. Melinda Keenan, a psychologist and executive director of the nonprofit, which opened its doors just before the pandemic, and since then, dozens have completed or are on their way to unparalleled healing. Let's start from the beginning. What were you seeing in your field that was lacking and ultimately led to this center?
Yeah, well, as you said, I was a psychologist in the VA system for a number of years, 19 years, and I was aware of some crucial gaps in the services offered. For example, family treatment. We were really looking at a model where we were treating the veteran without the family. And I think that the family obviously is crucial to healing folks with trauma. Yeah, you can't treat someone with trauma in a vacuum. So that was one thing. The other thing is that as I worked with the veterans over the years, we started to understand that there was more to trauma and the injuries that trauma inflicts on people beyond sort of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, okay? Beyond anxiety, beyond the hyperarousal, and that there were really some deeper core issues that were in these folks, really a soul wound, okay? Mm. Something much deeper. And so the field has finally started to come around to this idea that there are these core issues of unresolved loss, guilt, and shame. And they've started to look at that, and they've termed that moral injury. And so moral injury is something that happens in people of service who are exposed to traumatic events in which they are forced by their role to break their own moral values. And so specifically how we conceptualize moral injury in our program is that it's a broken relationship between people. Okay, so you feel as if you've perpetrated harm in some way against somebody else, either through action or inaction. So the program that we use at the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth is one that I developed with my colleagues over this these 20 years of talking with veterans and first responders. Okay, so this is a bottom-up program. This is what they have taught me about what they need. This is not a top-down where the psychologists up in the ivory tower, you know, say this is what we need to do to heal you, right? This was about what they taught me.
And as you so well put it, I mean, it's healing their soul. And it's a new field of psychology. You spent nearly 20 years with the VA. How did you discover moral injury?
Well, that's the thing, is that we haven't really discovered moral injury. Moral injury is something that's been around since people have been around. Okay. So you can go back into the ancient text, look at the Greek tragedies and things. And so much of the writings there is about moral injury, is about when people go to war or people hurt each other or do things bad to one another, that there are emotional consequences for that. And so I think that it's just taken the field this long to really sort of grapple with this and identify this as an issue, because we've been so focused, I think, on the post-traumatic stress problems and symptoms. Now, don't get me wrong, post-traumatic stress exists and is a true thing and is a very painful condition also. But I think that the treatment approach that we've used with post-traumatic stress is kind of almost like a 30,000 foot flyover. And the moral injury is really more of a deep dive down into, again, what it means to be a human being. You know, you have to grapple with spiritual issues. You have to grapple with moral issues. And what it means to be human and to feel like you've failed or harmed somebody. So it's not a symptom reduction kind of approach. It's much more of a you know, like I said, a deeper dive into these issues.
Yeah, a rebuilding bonds that maybe have been broken between human beings. And what you're talking about is the shame that disconnects people and comes along with making those decisions as a result of being a veteran or being a first responder. When you were listening to veterans at the VA, I mean, you touched upon this, but if you can expand, what did you learn from them in terms of moral injury when you're like something clicked with you and you created this center?
Well, I think, again, it was sort of a longer term process of me really getting to understand what the core of their pain is, you know. So a lot of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, for example, are skill sets that people learn in order to survive combat or trauma, too, you know. But these other issues are things that have to do with being being a person of service. And what makes you good at being a person of service is what makes you vulnerable to moral injury. So it's the most principled, competent, you know, honorable people that get wounded so badly because of this. So they have to break these values that are so dear to them. And so one of the most important things that we do in the center is, because we look at moral injury is broken relationships between people, everything we do is around relationship, okay? It's about rebuilding, it's about reconnection, okay? So we do group treatment. And of course, at first, folks who've been traumatized don't want to do group because they feel like we're going to be putting them in there with a bunch of people who won't understand, because they've already run into people who don't understand. Because if you haven't been there, but if you haven't experienced it, you really can't understand. So we put them in with what I call a group of worthy others, people who've walked the same walk, who have experienced the same things, and who are grappling with the same kinds of issues. And so pretty immediately they go, oh, this is different. And they say, wow, you know, that person could be, that person's in my head. That what that person said, I have said a million times to myself. So it becomes a really close-knit group. And if you think about how veterans and first responders work, they work as a team too. They can consider each other family. They have really strong bonds. And so we treat as they fight, right? So that's a really important aspect of our program. And then the other aspect is, many times these people the injury, like I said, it's broken relationships between people. So something happened between you and somebody else, but very often that person could be dead, or that person may be inaccessible to you in many other ways. So what we use is a letter writing technique, because the letters allow the person who feels like they've hurt somebody or lost somebody to have their say to that person. And the letters, they transcend time and space and dimension, if you think about it, right? It goes out. So they write the letter, and then what they do is they bring it in and they read it in the group. So they are putting it out into the universe. They are sharing it, and they're sharing it with each other and with the person that the letter is to. Okay. A lot of trauma programs will have them write a trauma account. So they write about the trauma. The letter writing is very different, because they're writing to the person that is involved in their trauma. Mm. So again, that's where the interpersonal piece comes in. And that's where our program is unique. Even the people that are talking about moral injury in the field, I think, have not personally figured out that particular piece of that this is between people. It's not an intrapersonal problem. It's not a problem just with the first responder. It's a problem of a broken relationship.
Yeah. And with that, it's not like people just live in houses with their doors closed in their own room. I mean, it doesn't work like that. I mean, there are families and loved ones that are part of this. How does this extend to family at your center?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can imagine living with somebody who feels like, you know, the way that they describe often their inner feeling is they say things like, you know, I'm a monster. I can't love. I have no heart. I became an animal. And they often feel like they don't deserve anything good, and they don't deserve to be in society anymore. Okay. Or they feel like they've failed in some core way. So shame pulls them away from the healing part of their families, pulls them away from the healing part of relationships. So you can imagine what that's like to be the spouse or child of somebody of service that has that, is carrying that burden. And it ripples out across all aspects of their lives. And so, of course, the loved ones are in that really tight circle in the middle there, right? So they're very often affected by this. And so we do some work with them as well in terms of educating them about moral injury and post-traumatic stress, and the fact that these folks are they're not broken. They're not, in fact, moral injury is not a diagnosis. It's not a, you know, it's a soul wound. It's what happens to people when good people are forced into situations where they feel like they've done harm. So, it's a soul wound. And so, the idea here is to help the families start to understand that, and help the veterans and first responders realize that they're not alone, and it's not that they're not a bad person. In fact, they're very good people. And that's exactly why they're there, because they're good people. You know, sociopaths don't get morally injured and they don't get PTSD, right? Because they don't have a heart, and they don't have a soul, and they don't have morals. But people, human beings, are the ones that, good human beings are the ones that get injured in these ways. Okay, so the family, it's really about education. And again, it's about getting them to reconnect with them and each other, and to realize that they're not alone, and they're in a community of people that are really, really special, actually. You know, they serve us selflessly and bear these wounds so that a lot of us don't have to.
To your knowledge, is this happening elsewhere? I know that moral injury, you know, it has been around cerebrally and discussions for a while, but in terms of what you are doing, was there a template or a framework that you could go off of?
No, no, this is just something that kind of evolved organically from my work with the veterans. And their discussions with me, sharing the realities of what they deal with and what they face day in and day out, in their heads and their hearts. And the letter writing just sort of came to me as a way to connect these people together. Again, the relationship piece. And I think that that is at the core of what's going on here. And like I said, there's not a lot of other programs that have kind of adopted that idea. I think they're still thinking about it as something that happens to a person of service. And so we have to just deal with that person and figure out a way for them to find some self-forgiveness, right? But in order to find self-forgiveness or to feel forgiven, I believe that the folks that I work with have to actually do something that makes them feel worthy of being forgiven or forgiving themselves, okay? So the letter writing is a way to say, I did this to you, I'm so sorry, and please forgive me. You know, if I could have done it differently, I would have, or I wish I could have done this or that or the other, you know, but I couldn't. And so the most amazing part of this whole thing too, Vicky, is that almost always when they write these letters and they read them aloud, there is some event that occurs. I call it a transformation event, some event that occurs in their lives that let them know that the person that they were writing to got the letter. Okay. Most often it's a dream of some kind where the person comes back to them in a way where, because typically with traumatic events, what happens is it gets burned into the limbic system. And so it's not a thought or a memory like regular memories. And so it plays like a DVD over and over and over. So the traumatic event, once it gets triggered, it just starts and it tells the story in the same way over and over. And there's something about the process of writing the letter and reading it aloud that I think shifts it out of that kind of trauma track, so to speak. And it allows them to access these people in a new way. Okay. So I think when we talked earlier, I think I told you one of the stories. I've got a few of them, but if you'd like me to, I can give you an example.
Yeah, please.
So I'll give you a little different one this time. So I had a Korean War veteran he had a buddy, and his buddy had they called him UT, and they both loved to fish. So they spent a lot of time talking about fishing. Okay. And so to pass the time. So anyway, one day they were out on a patrol. And they had a large truck with a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on the back. And the truck had a bunch of gasoline that it was carrying. And UT was on the gun. And a rocket propelled grenade came in and struck the truck with the gasoline, and it exploded. And UT was engulfed in flames. And my veteran saw him burn to death. In that process, my veteran also flinched and kind of ducked down behind the wheel of the truck. And so he labeled himself a coward because he felt like if he hadn't done that maybe he could have stopped it, right? Maybe he could have gotten to UT. Now, we know in our head, right? Logically, the rocket comes in, there's no way he's going to be able to save UT, right? But this is the difference between moral injury and looking at understanding that is going to be the response versus some of the cognitive therapies that we use for PTSD, where we try to reason through with people and say, well, you couldn't have done anything. That's what we say, right? But that doesn't translate to people's hearts and souls. They believe that, you know, that they didn't do what they should have done, okay? So in our approach, we say, okay, so you feel guilty. So what are we going to have them do, Vicky? What do you think we might have them do?
Write a letter.
Write a letter. And who would he write that letter to?
To UT.
Exactly. And what might he say in that letter?
I think he would apologize and say what he would have liked to have done better or a different outcome, and just really be open and vulnerable and share that with others in the group who have had their own unique experiences, but they're all connected by that sense of loss and guilt and shame.
Exactly. Very, very good, Vicky. Look, you're an expert already. And so anyway, yeah. And do you think it might be important for him to say to UT that he feels like a coward?
Yeah, I think that is important because it's good to get that out and to kind of change the limbic system and that replaying DVD that's going on, breaking that momentum.
Exactly, exactly. And so whether we believe he's a coward, whether we believe he could have gotten to save UT, that doesn't matter. It's what he feels in his heart. And so we have to go with that, but give him the path to then ask for forgiveness from the person, the only person who can give him that forgiveness, which is UT, right? So the veteran read this story in the group. And of course, all the other folks in the group have very similar incidents, right? The details are different, but the core issues are still the same. So at the end, okay, he reads it aloud. A couple weeks later, he comes back and he said to the group, he said, I had a dream I want to share with you guys. And we said, okay. So he said, in my dream, I went out to my mailbox, and in my mailbox was a card. And he described the card open, you know, not like right to left, but it was an up and down one, right? And on one side of the card was a picture. And guess who the picture was?
UT.
Picture of UT. Was he burned? Was he reburning? Was he dying over and over? No, he was smiling, right? Happy, healthy. And the card, in the card, he said that UT told him that he loved him and that he missed him and that everything was going great for him because he was living on a houseboat surrounded by fish.
Wow.
And he looked at me, my veteran, and he said, I know where that card came from. And he said, it came from heaven. So is he ever going to forget UT burning up? Is that ever going to go away? No. But what does he have now? He has literally a card and a picture from UT saying, I'm okay. I'm not burning. I'm living here on a boat surrounded by fish, and I still miss you and love you.
Wow. Dr. Keenan, we're going to end on that note. What a wonderful story. And thank you so much for all of the work that you do in starting this nonprofit.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me get the word out.
Yep, it's important. That was my conversation with Dr. Melinda Keenan, psychologist and executive director of the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth, which aired back in April. Still ahead, South Lake Tahoe is making a push to become a dark sky community. We'll revisit our conversation about how the designation can lead to healthier lives and brighter futures. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When we look up at the night sky, some of us are lucky enough to gaze at a sea of stars, spot a planet, or a streaking meteor, and if you're truly blessed, drink in the Milky Way. But for an increasing number of us in California and even the world, artificial light clutters the evening hours, turning night into day. One study estimates 80% of the world's population lives under light-polluted skies. Earlier this year, South Lake Tahoe joined a growing movement of cities that are exploring becoming a dark sky community. We spoke with Michael Marlin, an International Dark Sky Association ambassador, about how a darker sky could benefit South Lake Tahoe and every community across the country. Can you tell us just right off the bat what the International Dark Sky Movement is and what is the mission?
The International Dark Sky Association was formed several decades ago, and their mission is to educate people to the intelligent use of outdoor lighting. Intelligent use of outdoor lighting means learning how to direct your light to the target it needs to go to rather than going up. We've all seen these photographs from space of the cities, right?
Right.
And all of the lights. If you can see lights from that picture, that means that's light that's going up into the sky. And so it's not going to its target. So right there, that's already a huge waste of energy. So dark sky initiatives improve energy, improve the safety. It does a number of things. Supports migratory patterns for birds, nocturnal pollinators, sleep habits for people. And so light is a ubiquitous topic, and it really affects so many aspects of our lives.
When it comes to actually the metrics, how do you measure a dark sky?
That's a great question. There's a thing called a sky quality meter.
Okay.
And it's a little box, and it's got a little sensor on it. And you go to your place and you point it up to the zenith, the pinnacle at the top of the sky, and you take readings of light and see how much light is coming in.
So is it on a scale of 1 to 10 or just to, if you're comparing one area to another?
There's a thing called the Bortle scale, which was really helped drive this home for the city of South Lake Tahoe when I presented this in my Zoom presentation. This picture really shows what you would be looking at if you were in Sacramento, what the sky would look like. That's a 9, and it only goes to 9. And then
and 9 means light pollution, like the most light pollution.
Yeah, a number 9 is the worst, you know, it's as bad as it's going to get. There is no 10. And then a 1 would be someplace out in the wilderness. So that's your pristine night sky where you don't have any light pollution whatsoever versus being in an inner city.
So what's South Lake Tahoe on that scale of 0 to 9?
They are somewhere like around a 5 or a 6.
I think that would be pretty, I'm pretty surprised by that.
There's a lot more light there than people realize. You know, especially from the casinos and businesses. So that's really what they're addressing. And the city of South Lake Tahoe is moving to become a dark sky community, which means initially they're going to do this in a phased approach, first changing the sidewalk lighting, moving away from 4,000 Kelvin to a more dark sky friendly color. Temperature would be 2,700 or below, mm-hmm. preferably 2,200. And then after that, then moving on to the municipal buildings. And then after that, engaging the businesses. So it's going to be probably a 5 to 7 year process.
What would be the benefit to South Lake Tahoe to becoming a dark sky community and implementing these changes, which I would imagine would take several years?
Yes. Well, the first benefit is you're going to save money because you're using technology that uses far less electricity. You're going to reduce carbon greenhouse gases because, again, you're using less energy. You're going to improve safety because high intensity blue rich white light causes more glare and snow and rain. That's why our fog lights are amber. So it improves safety. It's going to improve the habitat for migratory birds, night pollinators, mammals. It's going to improve human health. The AMA found that this high intensity blue rich white light that people are exposed to have been linked to diabetes, obesity, melatonin suppression, depression, sleeplessness, and some forms of cancer. It also improves aesthetics. People like being able to see the stars. It preserves cultural heritage because the oldest stories that we tell are about the stars.
You gave this presentation to the South Lake Tahoe City Council. What was the response that you received?
It was great. I mean, it was really, so many people stepped up and said, oh, this is a great idea on so many levels. people sometimes think that a dark sky initiative means no light. That is just not the case. And a lot of people fear the dark. They think that it's going to create more crime. There have been no studies whatsoever that have linked darkness to crime. And my argument back to them is always, well, if light prevents crime, we wouldn't have any crime whatsoever during the day. But that's just not the case. So people called in, they thought it was a great idea. Then when the Tahoe Tribune published the paper and the story came out, there was lots and lots of comments, and all of them were totally positive. People like being able to see the stars. And when we allow ourselves to adapt our eyes to having its night vision, which is what we've evolved to do, it's a much more pleasant experience.
That was my conversation with International Dark Sky Association Ambassador Michael Marlin about his efforts to help South Lake Tahoe become a dark sky community. Our interview first aired in January. That wraps a special edition of Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.